You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 113, covering the week of March 19th through March 23rd, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your support of the Abbeville Institute. If you do like what we do at the Abbeville Institute, please follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all of those social media buttons at the top of our page at abbevilleinstitute.org. So you can click on those and go over to them. You can also click on our Amazon Smile button, where you can help support the Abbeville Institute while you're shopping at amazon.com. Also, while you're at abbevilleinstitute.org, you can give us an email address and we'll give you a free ebook. And you'll also get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday. Also, remember that we do exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you do like what we do at the Abbeville Institute, please consider a tax-deductible donation to the Institute. On our webpage, you can go to the top of the page where it says support. Click on that. There's a drop-down menu there, and there will be memberships for individuals for as little as $3 a month if you're a student or $5 a month if you're not a student. You can help support the Abbeville Institute, help support our podcasts, our website, all of our programs, and anything that you contribute is greatly appreciated. Also, while you're at the support page, you can see a little button that says shop. You can go there and get your Abbeville Institute gear, your apparel. You can get hats, shirts, all kinds of great things. So go on out and do that as well. You can download our app. Go to your app store on your mobile device. Get the Abbeville Institute app where you can get this podcast and all of our lectures. All of that is free. And all of that is supported by your donations as well. Also, if you do like our material on social media, the way that social media is changing, please share our material around on social media. The way the algorithms and other things have changed, it's harder and harder for us to get our material out there and in front of people to see. So please, if you like what we do on social media, please share it around as well. Any of that will help expand our message. Okay, all of that said, time to talk about the material for the week. We had a lot of good stuff, and so it's one of these things that I think the Institute, a couple of the pieces this week really exemplify our effort to bridge the gap between understanding in the South of, you know, thinking that the South is a four-year period of American history, 1861 to 1865, that Southern history really is 400 years of history. It's not just a four-year period when the South declared its independence and was fighting for its independence. Southern, that was an embodiment of what the South already considered itself to be, which was a unique section in the United States. But outside of that, even before that, and then of course after that, you had a distinct Southern culture, a distinct Southern heritage. And I think that the one period of Southern history that's often forgotten and neglected is the early 20th century South. And so we had a couple of pieces this week that focus on that. And I would hope that more and more people, particularly academics, who are listening to this podcast, thinking about going to graduate school, thinking about doing things in Southern history, would think about that period of time. Maybe from about the 1880s into, well, around the Great Depression, the 1930s into the 1940s, because there is so much to talk about in that period, particularly when it comes to political history. And one of the things I've told graduate students is that if they're looking at this period of time, you can actually find a way into the academy, because Southerners were looking at the world around them in that period of time, and they were looking at the financial apparatus that had been established by the war, by the Lincoln administration, and then by the Gilded Age, when the Republican Party controlled the general government. And they were criticizing that particular fusion, that Hamiltonian America, that fusion of finance, capital, and government. And so you had people like Arsene Pujol, and you had people like Henry Dillamar Clayton, and Carter Glass, and some of these individuals in Congress, Oscar Underwood, who were certainly interested in this new type of American economy. And they were critical of it. And so when you look at that, and you look even into the New Deal period, And some of the things that were said about the New Deal in the South. Now, of course, anybody that writes about this period often focuses on these individuals and their views on race. But their views on race were generally accepted by America in general at that time. When you have, and the first piece I'm going to talk about, I'll discuss that a little bit, but that was accepted across the United States. So the Southerners weren't unique in their views on race in the early 20th century. Americans in the 20th century generally held the same views. But they were unique in how they were attacking this new fusion of finance, capital, and government. And so that particular position is often accepted by leftists. When you look at the attack on the Federal Reserve, for example, or tariffs, or taxes, these type of things, when you look at support for farmers, those type of positions were well accepted by leftists today, or are well accepted by leftists today. I'll never forget when I was assigned I'll Take My Stand in graduate school, and the hippie that was in the class with me, he loved that book because it was agrarianism. And he thought, yeah, this is great. You know, the South and the agrarian position, I like that part of it. And so you do have an in there if you're studying Southern history that you can take that and run with it and perhaps be accepted if you want to get into the academy, be accepted in the academy. And there are all these different Southern political leaders that need more attention. So think about that. And I'm going to talk about a couple of them here. And I would hope that, you know, this would maybe pique some interest for some people and look at this 20th century period of Southern history. If I had to do it all over again and go back through graduate school, I think this is the period I would focus on because it really is a period. This and also this, what's often called, quote unquote, Northern opposition to the war, I think that's a period that's also out there for study and for greater analysis. And I did that a little bit. But that's a growing field as well. So there are a couple of areas I think that you could focus on that would be, if you're a graduate student, that would be acceptable in the modern academy. So let's start with these couple of individuals in the New South that I think are interesting and also which show that Southern history is not just a four-year period. So the piece we ran on Monday is entitled The Lost Tribes of the Irish in the South. And this is an address that was given in New York City in the 19-teens by Irvin S. Cobb. He was invited to New York to give an address about the Southern Irish. And this was before a large contingency of Irish. Now, not many people know who Irvin S. Cobb is. But in the 19-teens, Irvin S. Cobb was the highest paid journalist in the United States. He was from Kentucky. He had written a number of interesting stories, the Judge Priest stories, which later became feature films. He had written these. But he also was a well-respected journalist. In fact, he worked for William Randolph Hearst's newspaper in New York. And so here's a guy from the South that everyone loves. And he gave this particular talk before a bunch of New Yorkers, Irish New Yorkers, and he defended, or at least exposed, Irish Southerners to the North. And Cobb found out through his genealogical research that he was actually, in fact, Irish, that he wasn't Anglo-Saxon. And in the early 20th century, when people spoke of race, they actually spoke of the Irish as a race, as Anglo-Saxons of a race, as Germans of a race. This is what they talked about when they talked about race. It was not just skin color. It was, what is your ethnic background? Where are your people from? That was a race. And people were very interested in that in the Progressive Era. These are all progressives. Cobb was a progressive. He was a New South proponent. But he also admired the old, and he admired Southern tradition. He really liked it. And when you look at these stories that he wrote, they're very progressive, even in their interaction between white and black Southerners. He held views on race that were typically held by all Americans. He made racial jokes at times, and even in print, he made these kind of jokes, and people accepted these things, as they don't accept them today, but they were accepted in the early 20th century. And so when you go back and look at these individuals and people say, well, we're just going to focus on their views on race, you're missing the entire picture. If you just focus on that one, then you're going to have to focus on all of America. And this was the same thing in the 1850s, which we've talked about on this podcast, and how these positions on Lincoln's positions on race were the same as Jefferson Davis's positions on race. They were one and the same. They were no different in the 1850s in particular. So you get into that area that people say, well, I mean, these were odd. They weren't. Not for the time. But I love this piece because he actually talks about the beauty of the South. And there are a couple of real interesting comparisons he makes. He talks about, for example, how it was the northern part of Germany. He says this, to the north, to Prussia, the German Empire has always looked for its great scientists and its great mathematicians and its propounders and expounders of a certain cool and analytical philosophy. But it was to the south, to Bavaria and to Saxony, that Germany had to turn for its poets and its storytellers. He says the same thing is true in France. The same thing is true in Ireland. To the north of Ireland, as we know, has fathered the great businessmen of that little island, and the great manufacturers and the great theologians, many of them. And regretful to say, it has also produced a spawn of human beings who, in the face of the fact that in every other land where men have equal opportunities, the Irishman has won his way to the front and has held his own with prince and potentate, yet cling to the theory that in Ireland, of all the spots of the world, the Irishman is not capable of governing himself. But it was to the south of Ireland, and it is to the south of Ireland today, that one must turn to find a dreamer, and the writer, the idealist, and the poet. It is the south of Ireland also that one must turn to seek for a people whose literature and whose traditions are saddened by the memory of the wrongs they have withstood and the persecutions they have endured and still endure, and yet whose spirits and whose characters are uplifted and sanctified by that happy optimism which seems everywhere on this footstool to be the heritage of the true Southerner. Think about that. The Southerner. And he's saying Southerner as the southern part of Ireland, but he's also saying Southerner in Southern America. He says, in a measure, these same things are true of our own country. The North excels in business, but the South leads in romance. The North opens wide the door of opportunity to every man who comes to its borders with willing hands and eager brain and commands him to get busy. The South opens a door too, but it is the door of hospitality, and it bids the stranger enter in, not so much for what he can give, but for what he can take in the way of welcome. I think there is a reason, aside from topography and geography and climate and environment, for these differences between the common divisions of our great country. And the piece on Wednesday is going to talk about that as well. It's a little short story, but he's pointing out the differences between North and South is not just something unique to America, but it's the people there. It's the culture that makes them that way. And it wasn't the way they viewed other people. It was the way the culture was ingrained in that area. And you can look at that with David Hackett Fitcher's Albion Seed. And Herr Irvin Cobb is pointing out, and he points to Irish influence as well in this particular way. But think about that. You know, the North tells people to get busy. It's not that they don't welcome people in, because they do. But the South welcomes them in a different way. It's that Southern tradition that he's talking about here. And I love that about this piece. And he also gets into the great Irishmen of the South, people like Patrick Henry and Andrew Jackson and all these individuals. But here is a New South proponent, a man who was well-respected across the United States, a great literary figure, someone who's pointing out that the great things about the South, and this is unique because you had people say that the South had no literary tradition, that the South never produced anything because all it was concerned about was farming, that the only great literature, the great things came out of the North, and this is just so untrue. Literature and music are the things that make the South, the things that hold on to Southern tradition. I just attended a conference this past weekend, and there was a great lecture by a colleague of mine there, and it was about Southern music. And that's why we're doing our summer school in Southern music, because this is something that really embodies what the Southern tradition is all about. And I love this piece by Irvin Cobb for that. Here is a New South, somebody that needs more scholarly attention, Irvin Cobb, just for the literary quality of his work, for the fact of who he was in America. He needs more attention. He tells jokes during that. It's a great speech. I'm not going to read much more of it. It's a great speech, and it's one that I think really shows that Southerners were deep-thinking people, that they had in their own mind a vision of their own section, their own people, that was extremely long. They looked at this in what Browdell called the long durée, right? This long view of history. And it was tradition that they were concerned about more than anything else. Even progressives in the South were concerned about that more than anything else. When you read Henry Grady, you know, Grady is often held up as a symbol of the New South. Grady was very, very familiar with Southern history, and he never, never rejected it. He just said that the South is changing in terms of its economy. It has to embrace something else. But he always admired the people that came before him, the traditions that were there. And what he wanted to do, and what these New South proponents were looking to do more than anything else, is fuse the traditions that the South had with the new understanding of society that was going on. They wanted to put a Southern stamp on this new order of America. It's why you had the Callaway family, for example, in the middle part of Georgia, talking about making American citizens through cotton mills. It was a Southern model that was, they had to adopt this new Northern economy. To them, there was really no way around it anymore. They had to adopt it, but how are they going to make it Southern? How are they going to take something? How are they going to take literature and make it Southern? How are they going to take music and make it Southern? And that's the thing. It didn't just come here, and as again my colleague pointed out, you know, all these things came up from the people of the South. Even when you look at as a piece we ran last week on shape note singing, sacred harp singing, that hymn came from the North, but Southerners made it Southern. They made the music Southern. They make the literature Southern. So this is an interesting part of it, and I think when you look at the New South, that's why it's such an important part that needs more attention. And on Tuesday, we're in a review. This is actually published in the 1990s by Stephen Page Smith, but it's a review of a book entitled Southern Horizons by Thomas Dixon. And this is his autobiography. And the interesting thing about this book, nobody really knows much about Thomas Dixon. He was a pretty important literary figure in the early 20th century. He's from North Carolina. But the thing about Dixon that made him interesting was, in this particular book in any way, was his opinion on Reconstruction. He talks a lot about Reconstruction. And he talks a lot about how that affected the South. This is a Reconstruction story. And Reconstruction was certainly part of this New South and the development of the New South. And so Smith gets into this in this particular. He talks about, you know, the things that were going on. And he talks about, you know, modern views of Reconstruction, of course, in comparison to the views of Reconstruction at the time and how they were different. But he also talks about how this is so important to understand what was going on in the South, because it was the general government. And this was, you know, a period of time when people used to look at Reconstruction as a tragic era. It was the general government that was pushing these things. He says, many Americans today, in this age of historical amnesia, would disbelieve that one part of the country was once put under military occupation by another part, that heinous crimes went unpunished, that summary arrests and summary executions were common, that courts were subverted, legislatures corrupted, and the majority of the electorate disfranchised, all at the insistence of the federal government. that was the interesting part of Reconstruction for people. And of course, Dixon was, as he says, a New South booster. He depreciated farm life, favored industrial development. He considered himself modern. He considered himself a progressive. He liked Teddy Roosevelt. He voted for Roosevelt. He supported the New Deal. And this is why these particular individuals are interesting. And why these stories of New South individuals need to be told. And so I would implore people to go out and do more research on these individuals and read things on the New South. Don't just focus on that war. We have a piece this week on the war. But don't just focus on that war, because that sets us up for failure in terms of how we view the South. On Wednesday, we ran a piece entitled Streety. It's a little short story, and the picture that we use is John Randolph of Roanoke with his dogs on the floor of Congress. And this is a story about a dog named Streety. And I like this little piece by Paul Yarborough. He makes a couple interesting little observations about South and the North and how they view animals and animal husbandry and other things. And Randolph of Roanoke was often criticized by Northerners for bringing his dogs to Congress. He was an eccentric individual, and he brought his hunting dogs to the floor of Congress. You wouldn't get away with that today. But he talks about this stray dog that was found and how this one individual in this little town took him in. And he says, Streety was all over the neighborhood, a friend to all, large mutt of mixed ancestry. All of this was typical of small-town southern life. Not that Yankees didn't have small towns, dogs, or friends, but they weren't stranger-oriented, as they were more interested in what you did, money, as opposed to where you were from, family. It's a great little story, a great little observation in this story. It's the same thing that Cobb was talking about. Yeah, there's good people in the North, but they have a different view of society than the South. And he talks about how this dog was eventually hit by a car and how that changed this individual. He used to sit on the porch with his corncob pipe and with a dog. He cried. He says it's the first time he ever saw a grown man cry. And Yarborough says, as I got older, I was to look back and remind myself this was something coming to the South that would change its character to some extent. Cars and trucks racing through its neighborhoods was not localism, not Southern. And he says, I don't know why, but though I saw Mr. Worley on the porch after that, I never again saw him smoke his pipe. My mother said that maybe he had quit smoking, and he says, I thought maybe he had just quit. He had given up on what the South really was, and he had accepted its fate. And so, in some ways, you know, that's the New South. It's indicative of what's going on. But you had people in the early 20th century that weren't giving up. They were saying, okay, well, we have this thing, and how we make it Southern? What do we do with it? On Thursday, I ran a piece by Phil Lee entitled States' Rights. This is one where you get into the war, and his point is follow the money. And he critiques the people that push the neo-Confederate position, the pejorative, which is just silly. He pushes the new revisionism that the war was just all about slavery, that nothing else. But his question is, why did the North want to preserve the Union? And this is really where you have to get into this idea of what's going on here. The North could have just let the South secede. I mean, if what they really were concerned about was getting rid of slavery, you actually had abolitionists talk about this. You had Wendell Phillips say, well, look, we can't shoot at Southerners because they have the claim to 1776. You had Lysander Spooner say the same thing. Well, look, this is what we wanted. Abolitionists have been pushing for years to break free from slavery. So if this is what we want, let the South go. They have their own slaveholding republic if that's what they want. We can be free of it. But that's not what the war was really about. The war was there to prevent secession and to keep the Union together. But why? Why did they want to keep the Union together? It wasn't to end slavery. No. It was to maintain the economic muscle of the North. And as Lee points out, Jefferson Davis said in his first inaugural address, our policy is peace and the freest trade our necessities will permit. It is in our interests and that of our trading partners that there should be the fewest practicable restrictions upon interchange of commodities. The South offered France a special tariff exemption for a certain defined period in exchange for diplomatic recognition. A low Confederate tariff, he said, would present the remaining states of a truncated union with two consequences. First, the federal government would lose a large part of its tax revenue. Articles imported to the Confederacy from Europe would divert tariff revenue from the North to the South. Second, given the Confederacy's lower tariffs, its residents would likely buy more manufactured goods from Europe rather than from the northern states, where prices were inflated by protective tariffs. And so it was this interest in trade that caused many people to start saying, we need to keep this union, northern interests, to keep this union together. Charles Adams pointed this out. The historian Charles, from the Adams family, he said, quote, if trade were to shift to the southern ports because of a free trade zone, our extremely low duties relative to the north, then the great cities of the Northeast would go into decline and suffer economic disaster. The image painted by these editorials from newspapers of northeastern cities is one of massive unemployment, the closing of factories and businesses, followed by unrest, riots, and possibly revolution. The inland cities of the North would also go into decline, like Pittsburgh, where duty-free British steel and iron products would cripple the American steel industry. So here it is. He says, follow the money. That is why the North wanted to keep the Union together. It was about the Union. The war is about preserving the Union for the Hamiltonian system that came out of it in the New South. This is what I talk about. You know, where is the New South, the Southern critique? Well, this is it. They're critiquing this Hamiltonian system that is going to be foisted on the United States, North and South and West, by the war. So this centralization, this idea that there's going to be extreme centralization, and where that comes from is the point of the last piece of the week. His Truth is Marching On by Dissident Mama. It's the third part of this series that we published. And this particular piece is interesting because this gets into Northern ideology and this puritanical zeal to centralize, this puritanical zeal to expand and to make the rest of the United States in the image of the North. This is another Northern Studies piece, The Impact of the Enlightenment. And it's not that the South was immune to these things. Of course, it wasn't. But the way that the North believed in centralization, it had to be their way. It had to be their way or no way at all. That was Northern nationalism. You see, Northern nationalism was, in fact, sectionalism, disguised as nationalism. I've talked about this on the podcast before. We've had pieces about that. Southern nationalism was real nationalism. They wanted something that was benefiting the entire Union. This is what Calhoun said when he talked about the Union next to our liberty most dear. I mean, it had to be equally benefiting, the laws had to equally benefit and burden the North and the South. And if they did that, then they were a true law in the spirit of the Union. You couldn't just play favorites, one section over the other. This is what John Taylor of Caroline talked about that. Southerners were well aware of these things. Northerners wanted to use the Union to their advantage, which is what they considered to be nationalism. That's Hamiltonianism. Even when you look at Henry Clay, who was a Southerner, his American system, which is Hamiltonianism, I think in some ways Clay was still more of a real nationalist than the Northern purveyors of that particular position. He thought that these laws, unconstitutional as they were, would help the West and also Southerners. I mean, if you had internal improvements in the South, that would help the South and would help. But I think he was misguided in this, but still, because of the legal issues involved. But still, Clay was a nationalist in a way that even Calhoun was a nationalist originally. And Calhoun was a nationalist when he first started his political career. And he always said that he was a unionist, a nationalist, until the last day of his life. But the Union had to do what it was supposed to do. Calhoun, for example, advocated supporting internal improvements because it would keep the West and the South together, united as agrarians against these Northeastern manufacturing interests who wanted to hijack the country. And so this is why, you know, when you look at Northern studies and where you look at this cultural imperialism of the North, this is why they were doing it. It's why they were doing it. And the Constitution became the way to centralize. And Northerners rejected tradition. So even in the South, where you had progressives, they were still traditionally oriented. That was important. They still viewed tradition as essential, but they had to adapt the newness with tradition. They had to make it work. Northerners just wanted to bulldoze it all over, start over. It had to be something else. And so this entire series of pieces gets into why that was happening and why that was possible and why these things were taking place and why the Northern ideology was very dangerous for the United States. And all of that's to say, studying these things, studying this 400 years of Southern history, is important for understanding what the Southern tradition is and what it means for America today and what is true and valuable in that tradition. The critique of industrial capitalism, for example, of the fusion of government and finance, the real grounding of Southern literature, music, and culture, all of that, what all that means. Small is beautiful. That's what the South really is about and what we're trying to do with the Abbeville Institute. Until next time, good day.